always march ahead. We cannot turn back. There are those who are asking the devotees of civil rights, when will you be satisfied? We can never be satisfied as long as the Negro is the victim of all the unspeakable horrors of police brutality. We can never be satisfied. As long as our body is heavy with the fatigue of travel, cannot gain lodging in the motels of the highways and the hotels of the city.
We cannot be satisfied as long as a Negro in Mississippi cannot vote and a Negro in New York believes he has nothing for which to vote. No, no, we are not satisfied and we will not be satisfied until justice rolls down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream. I am not unmindful that some of you have come here out of great trials and tribulations. Some of you have come fresh from narrow jail cells. Some of you have come from areas where your quest for freedom left you battered by the storms of persecution. Yes. And staggered by the winds of police brutality. You have been the veterans of creative suffering. Continue to work with the faith that unearned suffering is redemptive. Go back to Mississippi. Go back to Alabama. Go back to South Carolina. Go back to Georgia. Go back to Louisiana. Go back to the slums and ghettos of our northern cities, knowing that somehow this situation can and will be changed. Let us not wallow in the valley of despair. I say to you today, my friend, so even though we face the difficulties of today and tomorrow, I still have a dream. It is a dream deeply rooted in the American dream. I have a dream that one day this nation will rise up and live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. Yeah. I have a dream that one day on the red hills of Georgia, the sons of former slaves and the sons of former slave owners will be able to sit down together at the table of brotherhood. I have a dream that one day, even the state of Mississippi, a state sweltering with the heat of injustice, sweltering with the heat of oppression, will be transformed into an oasis of freedom and justice. I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today. I have a dream that one day, down in Alabama with its vicious racists, with its governor having his lips dripping with the words of interposition and nullification. Yes. One day right there in Alabama, little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white boys and white girls as sisters and brothers. I have a dream today.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is the Monday Brown Bagger. I'm your tech this afternoon. I'm Ben. And now I'd like to pass it over to Reg. Here's Reg.
Hello, this is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. You're listening to the Monday Brown Bagger. My name is Reginald Angus Argue. I have as a co-host Tanya Hill. And today we're going to be talking about, it's Martin Luther King Day. It's January 21st. And even though Martin Luther King was born on April 15th, the United States made Martin Luther King Day on January 21st. Before we get to our guest, I just wanted to highlight a little bit about Martin Luther King. He was received many honorary doctrines in his life. In 1963, Dr. King was voted Man of the Year by Time Life. Also in 1963, Dr. King won the Nobel Peace Prize and was the youngest recipient of this award. And for his acceptance speech, he was saying, and I quote, "I accept the Nobel Peace Prize at the moment when 22 Negroes of the United States of America are engaged in a creative battle to end the long night of racial injustice. I accept this award on the behalf of the civil rights movement, which is moving with determination and majestic scorn for risk and danger to establish a reign of freedom and rule of justice. I am mindful that only yesterday in Birmingham, Alabama, our children, crying out for brotherhood, were answered with fire hoses, snarling dogs, and even death. I am mindful that only yesterday in Philadelphia, Mississippi, young people seeking to secure the right to vote were brutalized and murdered. And only yesterday, more than 40 houses of worship in the state of Mississippi alone were burnt, bombed or burnt, because they offered a sanctuary to those who would not accept segregation. I am mindful of the deliberating and the grinding poverty afflicting my people and the chains them to the lowest rung of the economic ladder. Therefore, I must ask why this prize is awarded to a movement which is beleaguered, that's committed to an unrelenting struggle, to a movement which has not won the very peace and brotherhood, which in the essence of the Nobel Peace Prize. After contemplation, I conclude that this award, which I receive on the behalf of that movement, is a profound recognition that nonviolence is the answer to the crucial political and moral questions of our times. The need for man to overcome oppression and violence without resorting to violence and oppression. Civilization and violence are antithetical concepts. Negroes of the United States, following the people of India, have demonstrated that nonviolence is not a sterile passivity, but a powerful moral force which makes for social transformation. Sooner or later, all the people of the world will have to discover a way to live together in peace and thereby transform this pending cosmic allergy into creative psalms of brotherhood." And that speech right there was so powerful. Luther King's life, he was a very powerful individual who moved mountains with just the use of his voice. Imagine what he felt like when he was standing there with other people down in Birmingham, Alabama, down in Montgomery, when the dogs were there, when the police had dogs and they had fire hoses and they had water. And here was a man that stood up to all that with people around him, and he said, "I'm not going to lift a finger, but I'm going to stand there because this is my right." And that is so beautiful, because I think that should be, everyone should have that right. We are all brothers and sister in the greater concept of humanity. That's what we have to realize. And if you take a look at every one of us, all of us, our skeleton is white. So what's ever above that? That doesn't make us any different. We're all the exact same. And now, hopefully I can introduce you to our guest. We were having a little bit of technical problems there. But our guests are Floyd Davis and Jerry Robinson from the Poor People Campaign Incorporated. Go ahead, Floyd.
Yes, good afternoon. How are you?
Well, thank you very much for agreeing to come on as a guest.
Thank you, thank you. We'd like to thank you for the opportunity to reach your audience on this day that we honor the life and works of Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr.
Well, that is so true, because I think he was a visionary that saw what humanity should become. And I was wondering if you could tell us a little bit about how your organization, the Poor People Campaign Incorporated, formed, where it originally came from, the idea, and how you yourself and Jerry reformed it.
Okay. Well, Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., and the leadership of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference conceived the concept of a Poor People's Campaign. And it was to focus attention on the plight of the poor in America and around the world. Dr. King realized that the next hurdle in the race to equality within our society would have to be overcoming the economic disparity that the majority of Americans faced every day, regardless of race. Now, the Poor People's Campaign did not focus just on just poor black people, but address all poor people of every minority, poor Mexicans, Puerto Ricans, American Indians, and even poor whites were included in the campaign. Dr. King labeled the campaign the second phase of the civil rights struggle. The first phase focused on segregation problems. Both phases were addressed in a nonviolent manner, and the SCLC leadership and Dr. King, before his assassination, planned for the Poor People's Campaign to be the largest, most widespread civil rights movement. Now, along those lines, they created a plan which asked for a $30 billion anti-poverty package that included more funding for housing for the poor and a guaranteed annual income for the poor people across the nation. These were things that are still just as important today as they were then, 40 years ago.
Yeah, Martin Luther King, he had many beautiful quotes during his life, and here's one that really caught my attention. I'm a veteran of the Canadian Forces, and it really caught my attention. A nation that continues year after year to spend more money on military defense than programs of social uplift is approaching spiritual death. Now, with the United States at this time spending billions of dollars each week on what's going on in Iraq and not supporting that Child Health Care Act that Bush turned down a few months ago. What is your thoughts on that? Floyd?
Yes, hello?
What is your thoughts on that?
Well, anytime you have a nation, as history has shown us, that focuses more on defense than the actual foundations of your society, they're doomed to failure. These things have been shown through history. I mean, because if you don't sustain the level of a culture or the traditional educational values, if you don't apply these things, make them first, where does the next generation go? That's when you start creating these subcultures. See? So, you know, the things what the United States are doing with the Iraq is no different from the things that were going on since the end of World War II and before with the military-industrial complex. Everything was based around that. They got away from it. They needed a ready cash influx, and they put the system back in order. But it's nothing new. It's nothing new. The thing is, we've got to bring attention to the plight of the people. See, the people get involved in the marketing of the politicians, and you get caught up in looks and images. But now you've got to bring attention to the issues. You've got to let the people be aware of, and not the candidate, it's the issues, and where does he stand on that as it affects you daily, personally. Because all politics are local.
And what kind of activities are yourself and Jerry planning to raise awareness of what's the poorest plight at this time in the United States?
Well, right now we're building our coalition. We've been working with major food distributor, food retailer, Jewel Osco here, and a food drive giveaway where they donated gift cards, and we ran public service announcements, and people call in if they're in trouble or they're having problems and they need a little assistance as far as groceries. We're working on that. We've got a housing program where we're in negotiation with the city of Chicago now to acquire land for the building of low-income affordable housing. We're also structuring a program with one of our advisory board members, Dr. Carol Smith, where we're going to have a AIDS awareness program situated. We're already licensed by the state for voter registrations, and of course that's a 24-hour-a-day program.
And with at this time, they're starting to tear down a lot of the projects. Are there any programs in place in either Chicago or any other United States city to help out the poor who are going to be displaced by the tearing of all these buildings down?
Well, they have a system in place. I believe they call it the Section 8 program. It's a housing HUD program. But the thing on that is there's talk of privatizing the whole industry, which is going to leave people in a very bad situation, because then you're dealing with corporate America. We know when it comes to corporate America, they do not care about the interests of the people that are dealing with what? The bottom line.
And also with, we have to remember that Dr. Martin Luther King, the late Dr. Martin Luther King, he also spent some time in the projects down in Chicago for a brief period of time. So he lived amongst the people. And not only did he talk about freedom, but he was also willing to sacrifice himself and his family. And that is so beautiful with that. Do you have any thoughts you have on that, Floyd?
Yeah, he was beyond just the message that he was bringing. He actually became the message. And that's what's important. You know, you have plenty that can point the way, like a block of wood. But when one clearly has left his footprints, then there's no doubt to as what he did, but for you to get to the point where you can follow along those footprints. And that's the concept behind the Poor People Campaign when we incorporated back here in the state of Illinois. We are following the tenets set down by Dr. King in reestablishing a coalition where we can address the issues of the poor. We once, and to the Southern Christian Leadership Conference, which was the organization that Dr. King formed, and have their participation with us in the Poor People's Campaign.
And also, Dr. King was talking about beyond Vietnam. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that. He was doing a speech where he talked about the... during the speech, it was given in New York, and New York Riverside Church on April 4th, 1967. And during the speech, he was talking about the impression with it going on within Latin America and within Vietnam itself. Yet, what happened to the United States is not willing to help those people. Instead, they're willing to help the oppressors. What is your thoughts on that, Floyd?
Well, Dr. King, he spoke out against the war, and he was slow to condemn the war in Vietnam, but he did make progressive movements toward a militant position that coupled the war in Vietnam with social spending programs at home. By April, 1966, King and SCLC board passed a resolution condemning the war. And at the SCLC annual convention in August, the SCLC called for the immediate and unilateral escalation of the war. Even as Dr. King was moving against the war, he was simultaneously growing more concerned with the plight of the poor. During the SCLC strategy session and at that fall, Dr. King proposed three initiatives for the organization, one of which was the Organization of America's Impoverished, towards a crusade to reform society in order to realize economic and social justice. In November of 1966, Dr. King told a Howard University audience that African Americans needed to confront basic issues between the privileged and the underprivileged. These issues not are not limited just to America. These conditions are applied in Latin America, South America, Africa, Asia. They're everywhere. The concept of poor, that's why Dr. King wanted to highlight the poor. During this time, you got to remember, there was a growing sentiment within the African-American community that everything was centered around black power. And the whole organization was being associated with the black power movement. But Dr. King wanted to show that his visions was a little larger than that. It was a little larger.
We now have Jerry on the line, too. Welcome for calling in, Jerry.
Hey, Randy. How you doing?
Great. Floyd and myself and Tanya have been talking about Martin Luther King. I was wondering if you could add a little bit to it. We talked about your organization. We also talked about the Beyond Vietnam speech. And we were also talking about how Martin Luther King was saying the nation continues year after year to support more money on the military defense than programs of social issues approaching spiritual death. So if you want to add something, just go ahead and jump in, Jerry.
That's true, because we really don't have, after the honorable Dr. Martin Luther King, we really don't have no leaders doing nothing after his death but looking out for themselves. That's all I see. You know, we got to, as a people, we got to come together and stand up and start fighting. You heard about that doggone H.R. 1955 bill. That takes away everything that Dr. Martin Luther King stood for.
Can you tell us a little bit more about that bill?
H.R. 1955.
And I'm not sure.
Freedom to protest, freedom to even speak your own mind. I did a couple of shows about it on the Blog Talk, so it's way out.
Well, the H.R. 1955 bill is going to broaden the definition of terrorism to encompass both First Amendment political activity and traditional forms of protest, such as nonviolent civil disobedience. Now, this is according to advocates, scholars, and historians.
Well, also,
anytime you see a law passed, it's gripping the people.
And
hello?
Also, Dennis Kucinich from the United States Congress, he was even calling it a thought bill. And quoting some words, if you understand what this bill does, it really sets the stage for further criminalization of protest. So what it's going to do in the future in the United States, anyone that wants to stand against anti-war, anyone that wants to do stuff which is against what the a few elitists down there wish to push upon the people, even if you're going to raise your voice. Now, the First Amendment gives you that right in the United States, and what this bill does is it takes the First Amendment, throws it right out the window.
Exactly.
Yes, exactly.
And also with this, we also have to remember other things that the Bush administration has done at this time. We also have to remember how that they're going to use clergymen to Homeland Security enlist clergy to quell public unrest if martial law ever declared. What that does is it turns around and uses Romans 13. It quotes Romans 13 to do it. Now, if you read the Holy Bible from the King James Version, it says, "Let every soul be subject unto the higher power, for there is no power but of God, the power that be ordained of God. Whoever therefore resisteth the power, resisteth the ordinance of God, and they that shall receive to themselves damnation." Now, New International Version says, "Everyone must submit himself to the governing authorities, for there is no authority except which God has established. The authorities that exist have been established by God. Consequently, he who rebels against the authorities is rebelling against God, what God has instituted, and those who do this will be bring judgment on themselves." Now, what I say is that the King James Version was the first one. The New International Version was the one that was... I think that a man has stepped in and has turned it and is trying to use religion. If you remember what Martin Luther King was saying, even Martin Luther King in the past was quoted as talking, if we allow our churches to change, then they'll turn into culture clubs. Would you like to add something, Floyd or Jerry?
Yeah, well, Dr. King spoke to
the truth. If we allow our churches to change what and over to politics?
No, what I was saying was Dr. King spoke the truth, and regardless to whatever your particular belief may be, you would be a fool to argue with the truth, just like Dr. King said, let's start from the beginning. In the Old Testament, you have the old law of an eye for an eye. But Dr. King said, the old law of an eye for an eye is going to leave us all blind. So he spoke a universal truth to let you know there was a new era of time.
So do you think the tide is changing and that people are waking up and that people are possibly willing to take a stand? What do you hope for in the coming election in the United States?
In the coming election?
Do you see anything? Do you see any big changes, or do you just see the same thing repeating itself?
Well, in this particular election, what I see is the Democratic Party, who traditionally has represented the rights of minorities, women, fighting it out, weakening their base, and then going into a full campaign against a Republican candidate who's going to come in with a well-oiled machine behind him as well. I just don't see the logic in the fight between Hillary and Obama. It would have made more sense to strategize and come up with an agenda that would include them both and strengthen the base, as opposed to having it, you know, kind of clashing at a certain degree.
And also, getting back to that quote, here's the quote. I found the quote from Dr. Martin Luther King. The church must be reminded that it is not the master or the servant of the state, but rather the conscience of the state. It must be the guide and the critic of the state and never be its tool. If church does not recapture the prophetic zeal, it becomes an irrelevant social club without moral or spiritual authority.
Exactly.
Yeah,
and
true.
And that reflects the same sentiment behind
true.
The letter from a Birmingham jail.
Went too far.
Yeah, because with that, the fact that the United States is going to use Romans 13 to as its train clergymen to step in and to quell martial law when martial law is declared in the next natural catastrophe or even man-made, that is an example of how, what Martin Luther King was saying, a few have allowed these churches to become servants of the state rather than the servants of the people. Because no matter what religion we are, we should all basically have the thought that no matter what you call God, whether you call God God or you call God Allah, it doesn't matter, because we're all praying to a God. We're all admitting that there's a higher being. And even the people that don't believe there's a higher being, you know, they're believing by living, they're believing in something.
Exactly.
And we can't basically condemn our other people because we may not agree with them.
Exactly. Well, if you ever do a comparative study of religion, you'll
see
that there's a common thread that unites all of them, and it's basically to believe and do good.
And we're going to take a quick break right now. Jerry and Floyd, if you just stay on the line, we're going to take a brief break, and we're going to go to some music. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 CFRO. You're listening to the Monday Brown Bagger, and we're going to take a break right now.
This ain't coming from no prophet, just an ordinary man. When I close my eyes, I see the way this world shall be when we go walking in it. For a crust of bread, when the last man dies for just words that he said when they're sheltered over the poorest head. We shall be free when the last thing we notice is the color of skin, and the first thing we look for is the beauty within. When the skies and the oceans are clean again, then we shall be free. We shall be free. We shall be free. Stand straight and walk proud, 'cause we shall be free. When we're free to love anyone we choose, when this world's big enough for all different views, when we all can worship from our own kind of pew, then we shall be free, yeah. We shall be free. We shall be free. Have a little faith, hold out, 'cause we shall be free. And when morning talks for the very last time,
welcome back to Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. You're listening to Monday Brown Bagger. Before I continue on, I just want people to know that for the people out there that think that, you know, this is not my fight, why should I worry about, why should I care about it? Now, what happens is there was a gentleman a long time ago, right after World War II was over, a pastor, Martin Nylander, who wrote a poem, and it was called They Came For. In Germany, they came for first for the communist, and I did not speak up because I wasn't a communist. And then they came for the trade unionist, and I didn't speak up because I wasn't a trade unionist. And then they came for the Jews, and I did not speak up because I wasn't Jewish. And then they came for me, and by that time, there was no one left to speak up. That's why I call for all the listeners out there right now, is I say to you, you know, even if you're not part of this fight, you have to join together. We have to join together as brothers and sister. Become our brothers and sisters keeper. With that said, we're having a little bit of technical problems, and we're going to continue on with Floyd. Jerry's going to call back a little later. Welcome back, Floyd.
Okay, I'm back. How are you?
Good.
Hi, Floyd. Yep. My name's Tanya. I'm Reg's co-host. I just wanted to get into the issue of the public school system in the United States. I was reading an essay about someone did a survey of the public school system in the United States and saying how it's still segregated pretty much in these low-funded schools. You'll see Latinos, African Americans, but you will not see a white person there. Supposedly a lot of so what what do you do you agree with that statement that the public school systems are not being funded, and that obviously it is an issue even up here in Canada?
Well, not only in Chicago, but around the United States, there's a regentrification process going on where they're reclaiming the quote-unquote inner cities, which were the traditional areas of low income. And they've come in and rehabbed these properties and driven the value of these properties up to the point where they no longer have to put up the sign that says no blacks allowed, but because of economics, you're not allowed. Hmm. So it's still another subtle form of racism that's systematic. That's much more damaging than the individual racism. When it's systemic, then there's a system in place that will not allow you as a people, as a class, as a segment of society, to elevate yourself. And that's what we've seen continuously throughout this country, at least for the last 40 years, and I'm sure for longer. But the protests have drawn attention to it in the last 40 years, but where is actually the progress? Individual, on some individual cases, yes, of course. We have our Oprah Winfrey's and our Magic Johnson's.
And do you see this underfunding of public schools as intentional?
Well, speaking from how they're doing it here in Chicago, once you come in and clear out the community, then that lends the credence to, well, this school is half occupied. So you come in and knock these schools down, close them down, then knock them down. And you consolidate maybe two or three of them, and you create these new fabulous, they call them teachers' academies here in Chicago. Now, you built these multi-million dollar educational centers, but you're constantly uprooting the people of the community and building the new housing that they can't afford to come back in. It's all part of one process. When you recognize that it's not so much attention drawn on the school system, but the system in place to uproot the whole community. Because they're building new schools. They're building plenty of new schools.
Do you see
but
that?
The populace that's coming back into them are not the people that was there initially before the new construction.
Do you see the what George Bush has is built, No Child Left Behind? How much of a, what role has that played on the American society?
I don't see too much of a great role that it's taken in our community. I see less opportunities for education. I see less services provided to the children. I see less equipment provided to the children. I don't really see where it's a help. I think it's another program that's, you know, locked into a bureaucracy and created some administrative positions and paid some salaries, and the wheel keeps spinning.
There's an article out there that was written by Alfred Porter, and it was called The American Dream Increasingly Out of Reach for the Black People. What are your thoughts on that, Floyd?
Of course. Again, it's systematic. We live in a community where everyone was sustained by manufacturing after World War II. Meatpacking, manufacturing, steel industries. And commencing in the late 60s, early 70s, after the urban unrest in America, throughout the country, a lot of these companies moved out of the inner cities. They moved all of the jobs where people can actually go in and work 10, 15, 20 years and retire with the gold watch and the pension. And the major workforce in our community became the service industry, hotels, restaurants, things of that nature. So it's not designed for people to, again, elevate themselves, because you're caught up in a job situation where you're only making enough money to pay and live from paycheck to paycheck.
There's Martin Luther King was quoted as saying, "A man is a man because he is free to operate within the framework of his destiny. He is free to liberate, free to make decisions, and to choose between alternatives. He distinguishes from animals by his freedom to do evil or good, and to walk the high road of beauty or tread the low road of ugly degradation." What I'd like to know with that, Floyd, do you see in the United States with the sports event coming up in Chicago, do you see that there's an awful lot of the poor are being basically pushed out of Chicago, and so that way that they can turn around and put this great big sports thing building in there, which in turn, once the event's over, it's going to be nothing. It's going to go right back to the exact same, and you're going to cause the neighborhoods in the community are going to be worse than they are right now?
I take it you're speaking of the 2016 Olympics situation?
Yes.
Yeah, right. Well, again, that's another project that unless the people are designed to be included in, we're going to be cut out of. I mean, there's going to be, you know, forget about the sports stadium. Let's talk about building the sports stadium. There's going to be so many opportunities and so much money and contracting coming through there in these traditionally impoverished communities. But history has shown us with the construction that's going on now, less than 10% of the workforce will include the people where these dollars are being spent.
Yeah, we're also seeing that at this time in Vancouver, where we're at right now, if the Olympics is coming here in 2010, and what happens is we're running up a deficit of over, you know, $2, $3, $4 billion. And
exactly.
Who's going to have to pay for the bill? It's going to be the children, the future generations, and the taxpayers are going to be left on hold just so they can have their little party, which is only going to be, you know, 2-3 weeks long. And then what afterwards, we all have to pay for it. What happens, what I like to know, is it really worth it to have the party if the money that is being wasted on these activities could be better, you know, we could put them to better programs? So why are we having the parties is what I'd like to know.
Well, in Chicago, under Mayor Daley's tutelage, they've instituted another program. What they've done, and don't quote me exactly on these figures, but it's somewhere $100 million, $200 million. That's been spent up to this point in promoting Chicago for the event. But it's mostly been paid for, and if not entirely, by private donations. The major companies and is paying this money to help bring the business into Chicago. Now, in the future, I'm quite sure the city is going to have to pick up some tab somewhere down the line. And, of course, the people are going to suffer for it. But the overall objective with these type of events, they're money-making spectacles. They're money-making spectacles. The object of it is to go in there and make the money, whatever money is going to be made, and they filter it through and they keep on moving. That's just all in the wheel. I mean, that's the reality of it. That's Halliburton. That's Iraqi War. I mean, that's Vietnam. That's the Goodyear. I mean, it's history. That's the DuPonts. You go back through the French Revolution. They were manufacturing the gunpowder. I mean, but everybody, you know, history. Once you know history, once you study history, you'll see that it's a system in place designed to keep a class society.
Yeah, we also have to remember that Bush has ran up the deficit in 6 years alone, $4 trillion himself. Add on the $4 trillion United States already owed. You're eight, and you'd soon be reaching nine, then $10 trillion. What we have to realize is that this has to be paid sooner or later. And what you're seeing here in Vancouver, British Columbia, is you're seeing examples of that they're already we're paying for it in society here. You're seeing East Hastings, which United Nations and even Dan Rathers was talking about how horrific the conditions are in this area. Yet what happens is that everyone's painting this gigantic, beautiful picture about Vancouver being a beautiful city to live in, but they're
exactly.
Not realizing what's happening with the poverty. What we have to do as a society is we have to address those issues first before we start promoting ourselves, because we're all brothers and sister keepers. And what is the conditions like over in Chicago? And do you have, what are your ghettos like over there?
Well, I look at Chicago in a sense where the conditions now, 2008, are the same as they were in 1968. You can still drive through the community and see the just total poverty, man, in a city which is, what is it, second, third largest market in the United States. It's ridiculous. I mean, as the United States government saw fit to spend, what is it, $750 billion now on the Iraqi war with the infrastructure crumbling, it's the same situation here locally. I mean, you see the city with the grandiose plans, but the calls and the concerns for the underprivileged is push them out. See, in Chicago, there's two things about to happen. One, we spoke of earlier, the 2016 Olympics and the legalization of casino gambling. Okay? So in order to push these type of agendas, your city has to have an image that's squeaky clean. It has to be, and the mindset has to not and no longer be Chicago, the city of Al Capone, and the gangsters, okay, and the gangs and the high crime. You've got to cut this stuff in order to get the bonding. Once you get the bonding, you get the approval, you get the money, you do your building, and you draw the people. But the people are only going to come if they feel safe. Now, over the last 2 years, yes, of course, the murder rate has been dropping in the city of Chicago. Well, every time they come into the community and wipe out a whole housing project, well, it's undisputable. We can't deny the fact that the rate of crime is high there because of the way it's conditioned. But when you remove those housing developments, and the city of Chicago is moving them two, three at a time, and you're sending them to the suburban areas with the public assistance programs, well, the crime rate drops.
Well, up here in Canada, there's actually a recent study done instead of tearing down so-called projects, actually putting money into these areas and putting infrastructure, community centers, instead of just getting rid of them, that things are getting better, education centers, for example, that there is no need to tear down these projects. What are your thoughts on that? Or are there any groups that you know of who are trying to rehabilitate these areas?
Yes, the Poor People Campaign Incorporated. Mm-hmm. We're working. See, all of those issues and concerns that you just addressed are great, but our perspective is they're secondary, because until we can provide an economic base again, we can't enjoy the luxury of those other issues and the thing and the concerns you just mentioned. We have to reintroduce manufacturing into the inner cities. You come in and the cities, and the developers, they build up all of this property. There's no problem. It's very simple to come in and rehab a building. The issue comes in when it comes to occupancy. Because now, the family that moved out of there paying maybe $500 a month, when they go back to look at that same apartment, they're being told now that that's a $300,000 condominium. So, if they're working in the retail industry, they will never be able to achieve the economic parity to enjoy the comforts of this new Chicago, this new rebuilding. We've got to introduce manufacturing, and we're working now with a screw and bolt manufacturer that's located, again, in the suburban area and has been in the suburban area for the last 20 or so years. But we've been in negotiation with them and the city to acquire the needed space so that they can move this company back into the city. Now, once we move this company back into the city, this company is going to start providing jobs to the community. They provide those jobs, now we have a salary which helps uplift the people's living condition. The city is going to make money because they're going to tax. not only the individual that's working, but the company. These people presumably will go out and purchase homes in the community that's sitting empty now because no one's going to buy them. And then that invisible hand of capitalism starts working again in these areas. But if you don't have an economic base, how can capitalism affect those people? You take out the economic base, there is no capitalism.
Well, thank you very much for calling and talking with us this afternoon there, Floyd. I'm Ben. I'm just the tech guy for Monday Brown Beggar. Thank you very much for calling in, because we have Jerry on the other line. Would you like to carry the hold, or do you have to go?
Well, that's going to be the problem, I think, if you're trying to run both lines. Is that correct?
Yeah, because it's going to be really hard for us down in here in Canada.
Right. Well, why don't you let Jerry close it out? I really appreciate the opportunity to speak this afternoon, and may everyone, the listeners, have a beautiful Martin Luther King Day from Chicago.
Thank you.
Thank you very much there, Floyd. Appreciate
Thank
that.
Thank you.
Jerry, go right ahead with Reg.
How y'all doing? We must remember that nothing was given to us without sacrifice, so we all have to stand up and start pushing, stand up for what's right in our communities and every state, because we got a hell of a fight if this 1955 bill passed.
Is there a march coming up soon?
Well, I was looking at seeing how we're going to get this going, because we may have to do one on this 1955 bill, because nobody seems to want to address this bill in Chicago. Nobody is saying nothing on the issue about this bill. I mean, they kept this bill a secret all the way through to the Congress. Now it sits in the Senate. We would have never known unless, you know, without the people leaking it from the somebody, you know, getting it and leaking it to the Blob Talk and MySpace. We would have never known about this bill. We would have looked up, been trying to go down there to get some papers to have a march or something, and they'd have been telling us, no, do y'all know y'all can't march? This is against the law now. Well, then we'd have said, well, we got freedom of speech. No, you don't have that. That's against the law, too. Now, we have, you know, Martin Luther King, he laid down his life, and others that marched with him, white and black, and Mexican, and Jewish peoples, laid down their lives. And we then gave it all up. What's wrong with this picture? What's wrong with going down in 2008? Here it is, 40 years later, since the man been gone. No leaders, so-called leaders, haven't even spoke about this bill. I mean, Jesse L. Sharpton, nobody has spoke about this bill. Nobody. And this is ridiculous.
We also must remember what Martin Luther King said about freedom. Freedom is never voluntarily given by the oppressor. It must be demanded by the oppressed.
That's right.
And that's what you're doing right now, Jerry.
We must start standing up and demanding, because they're getting ready to oppress us all over again. I mean, in every state.
Do you see happening in the United States that one day when they're going to start breaking down the doors, start carrying people away just for having a Bible study in their own home, just for basically talking about how their interpretations of the Bible dictate that we should be basically protecting everyone? Do you see that happening?
Yeah, I see it happening. I see it happening through this New World Order bill, H.R. 1955. I see it happening. I see it happening, and it's going to happen if we don't stand up and stop letting them put racism in our face, like with this campaign. They keep on hollering, oh, Obama, is he black enough? Oh, is he talking about Hillary? Oh, because the Ku Klux Klan is over here. They want you to continue to have this racism thought in your head, in your mind, in your soul, where you continue on with this here crap while they continue pushing the doggone big picture over our heads.
Also, when my wife and I were in Las Vegas, just after we got forced to leave Canada due to my writing for almost 5 years of our lives, the first words to us was from a man in Las Vegas, and it was a homeless man, and the man was Afro-American. And he said to me, because you're white, you'll be okay. And I just looked at him. I was floored by those comments. I couldn't believe it because I'm an idealist. I believe that everyone is the same. And to hear those words in that was almost 6 years ago now. So that correction, that was end of September 2001. To hear those words in the 21st century, I couldn't believe that.
You couldn't. But I'll tell you one thing, Brother Randy. This is really getting to the point where they're trying to put races together, like they was trying to get blacks to go against the immigration. Yeah, go against the Hispanics, and they taking over all the jobs. They the ones who knocking y'all out of jobs. They tried to do. They still, and in some states, they still trying to get, you know, the black and the brown to go against each other. They've been doing this for over 50 years, man.
Well, we have to get going pretty quick, Jerry. So could you quickly tell the people your blog your blog radio address, and also tell them your MySpace and your website where the people can reach you at to find out more information about your organization?
Well, you can come on my radio show every Tuesday and Friday at 7 p.m. Central Standard Time, and you type in the Poor People's with an apostrophe S, Campaign, Inc., and then hit search. It'll bring up everything on the Poor People's Campaign, Inc. It'll bring up the MySpace pages and the Black Planet websites and the Blob Talk Radio Internet show.
Well, thank you very much for coming on today, Jerry. And tell Floyd we also said thank you. This is Co-op Radio 102.7 FM, CFRO. You're listening to Money Brown Bagger. It's January 21st, 2008. Thank you very much for listening. And as I'm leaving, I like to leave people with a quick poem against the impossible. When the immense mountains and terrain stand in front of you, when the sounds of thunder and the signs of lightning cover your pathway that you travel, when your feet are swollen and your hands are cold, when your stomach is aching and your body is sore, when others have stumbled along the way, do not give up where you're heading to in your life. For what separates the few from the many is the deep inner desire that drives people to do the impossible while holding true to what is right in their lives. And I wrote that in 2005, and that's so true in life. Thank you, everyone, for listening, and have a great day.
I was waiting for so long for a miracle to come. Everyone told me to be strong, and don't shed a tear. Through the darkness and good times, I knew I'd make it through. And the world thought I had it all, but I was waiting for you. Hush, now I see light in the sky. Oh, it's so. Strength all in the eyes of tears. Let it fill my soul and drown my fears.
The Vancouver Pan-African Film and Arts Festival presents Traveling Pan-African Film and Arts Festival Black History Month 2008. Themed Celebrating Our Cultural Diversity, Embracing Our Human Kinship, it's a true Canadian heritage celebration through dialogue and art. Where, you might ask? Burnaby Shadbolt Center for the Arts. That's located at 6450 Deer Lake Avenue in Burnaby. For more information on the Black History Month 2008 event, please call 604-205-3000.